In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Jean Driscoll. She is, among other things, the only person ever to win the Boston Marathon 8 times. She's also won a lot of other athletic awards. She's a 2-time silver medalist at the Olympic Games, world record holder in the 10,000 and the marathon. She holds 5 of the world's top 10 best times in the marathon, 4 gold medals, 2 silver, 3 bronze in Paralympics. She has just recently published an autobiography talking about her life, her childhood, how she came to wheelchair sports, and it's titled Determined to Win. It's published by Shaw Books and is out now if you would like to take a look at it. And if you would like to talk with her, all you have to do is call us. If you want to be a part of the conversation, you can call us 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, you can call and join the conversation. She's been featured on a lot of programs, Good Morning America, Nightline, Today, and was the subject of, I think, a pretty good documentary published, produced right here by Allison Davis, titled Against the Wind, that aired on more than 400 public TV stations around the country. And we're very pleased to have you here. Thanks.
Hey, I enjoy coming here.
Well, let's talk about you. I guess that's what we're here for. You were born with a condition called spina bifida.
I was born with spina bifida. Spina bifida, much as to the surprise of a lot of people, is the leading birth defect in this country. 1 in every 1,000 babies born is born with spina bifida. And when I was born in the mid-60s, nearly half the babies born with spina bifida died because of infection that got into the opening. Spina bifida is an open spine, and the opening in the spine starts to form within the first 2 or 3 weeks that the baby is growing inside of the mother. And doctors and researchers aren't quite sure what causes it, but when you hear and read about mothers who are either trying to get pregnant or are pregnant to take folic acid, it's to help prevent neural tube defects such as spina bifida.
Yeah, and that's it's one of the B vitamins, right? B
yes.
Something or other. Anyway,
yes.
So it's the kind of thing, so by taking a very simple nutritional supplement, pretty much you can make sure that it doesn't happen.
Well, it's not 100% cure of spina bifida, but it greatly decreases the incidence of it if you do mm-hmm. take it.
So then as a result, you when you were a girl had that one particular challenge. But now for people might be surprised knowing you as a wheelchair athlete, for some of your childhood, you with the aid of braces on your legs, you could walk.
Yes, I could walk. When I was born, the day I was born, doctors immediately started placing limitations on my life. They told my parents I'd probably never walk, never go through a regular school system, and most likely would be dependent on them my entire life. But I think I was born with a God-given prove-you-wrong attitude. And when I was 2 years old, I did start walking with below-the-knee braces independently. When it was time to go to school, I went to the same school that my siblings went to. And as far as being dependent on my parents, I've been around the world, and they're chasing me. trying to keep up with me. But yes, I was able to walk. Spina bifida, much like spinal cord injury, can occur anywhere on the spine. And the closer you are to the brain, the less function you have, the more damage there is. The farther away from the brain you are on your spine, the more function you'll have, the less damage you will have. The opening on my spine was fairly low on my back, and because it was fairly low, I did have an ability to walk for the first 19, 20 years of my life.
Yeah. Well, you really seem determined from what I read in the story, not to be held back by that and to do things that other kids did to as much as you possibly could, even to the point of deciding you were going to ride a bicycle come heck or high water, and did.
Yes, I wanted to be just like everybody else. In my mind, I was just like everybody else. At home, I had to help out with the dishes and clean my room, and my Saturday job was to clean the living room. I went to school and had to do homework. I mean, I was held accountable for everything that everybody else was. I had responsibilities like everybody else. And so with those responsibilities, I also wanted to have fun like everybody else. And I was in fourth grade when I learned to ride a two-wheel bike. I was bound and determined when a friend of mine who was 2 years younger came over and showed me that she could ride a two-wheel bike. I was embarrassed to go anywhere on my bike. When you're in fourth grade and you have training wheels on your bike, it's just not a cool thing. So I didn't go around a lot on my bike with training wheels. But one Saturday, I spent 8 hours trying to master riding a two-wheel bike on my friend Marcy's brother's bike. Marcy was the girl who was 2 years younger, and her brother was a kindergartner who had a bike small enough that when I sat on it, my feet could touch the ground flat-footed. Because of the spina bifida, although I could walk, I always had weak lower body musculature. I'd never been able to feel my feet, wiggle my toes, and move my ankles. So that's why I needed the braces, but I couldn't stand on my tippy toes either. So I needed a bike on which I could get my feet flat on the ground. And that happened to be little Ricky's bike, and I had it all day one Saturday, but eventually learned to balance on that two-wheel bike and was incredibly elated.
Yeah. Well, when you announced to your parents that you could do this, what was their reaction?
Well, I went home, and Marcy accompanied me home. My dad was at work that day, but I ran into the house, and I told my mom, Mom, I can ride a two-wheel bike. Come out and watch me. She said, you stay off that thing. You're going to break your neck. She was a nurse. She'd seen lots of things. I said, please, just come watch me. And I started riding around the driveway, and she said, well, I guess you can. Maybe when your dad comes home from work today, he can take the training wheels off your bike. And I was so proud. It was a step of independence and freedom, and also one more thing that made me like the other kids. It was one less thing. I was different. Yeah. One less way I was different.
Jean Driscoll is our guest this morning, this part of Focus 580. And as I mentioned, if you're interested in reading about her life story, she's put out an autobiography. The title of the book is Determined to Win. I'm sure that you can find it in the bookstores. And again, if you have questions, you can call us 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, what was the experience that you had as a disabled kid in school like?
I was the only kid with a disability in my grade school, and there were lots and lots of stairs. The older you got, the more stairs there were to climb. But even in first grade, there were probably about 20 or 23 stairs. I counted them one time, and I can't remember, just to get up to the first grade rooms from the playground. I got passed a lot. Kids would huff and sigh if they were stuck behind me in line because I couldn't walk as fast. I couldn't climb stairs as fast. So it was very humbling. And being a child growing up with a disability is a very humbling situation at times. I didn't have much self-esteem. Not only I walked awkwardly, and not only did I walk awkwardly, but I also didn't have normal control over going to the bathroom. So I had very many embarrassing, humiliating situations where that was concerned, and I was an easy target. I was an easy target for kids at school to tease. I was an easy target for my four siblings to tease at home. There were things in which I just didn't measure up physically, and that was really hard.
Mm. Well, it's funny, when you said there were a lot of stairs, you were talking about the things you climb, and I was thinking people were staring at you.
Oh, well, that too. I got stared at a lot. But S-T-A-I-R-S.
Okay. You talked about the fact that your mom was a nurse, and that when you were growing up that you had responsibilities around the house that you were expected to do with the same kind of stuff that you have one sister and three brothers.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah,
that your sibs were doing. Uh-huh. But it also seemed to be that there were times when there was something that you really wanted to do, and your mom seemed to be saying to you, you should live with your limitations, and that there is some stuff that you're just not going to be able to do.
Well, that's exactly what she would say. And she definitely tried to raise me according what the doctors said would be likely. I remember going in and seeing doctors very frequently, and my orthopedic doctor often told me, Jean, you need to slow down. You shouldn't be walking this much. You shouldn't be running. You're going to wear your body out. And as a kid, you just think that that's not going to happen. I would look around at my siblings and nobody was telling them that. I really didn't understand my disability. I didn't understand the muscular weaknesses that I had. And so it went in one ear and out the other. And perhaps some of it was denial. I didn't want to believe it. But I honestly didn't think he knew what he was talking about, because I could do everything except for walk as fast and run as fast as everybody else. Yeah.
And your brothers and sister, they cut you no slack, I'm sure.
Oh, no, no. My siblings cut me no slack. In fact, while we were growing up, if you would have looked up sibling rivalry in the dictionary, all of our names would have been there.
Would have been a picture right there. Family
picture. Yes.
Well, you talked about how you really wanted to ride the bike, and you found the bike that you could manage and learned, and then came home and said, I'm ready to do, I'll show you, take the wheels off. Then later on in the book, you talk about there was something in school where you were, I forget what exactly the thing was. Yeah, it was a readathon. Mm-hmm. And the prize was a bicycle.
Yes.
Which you really wanted to win. And
oh, yes.
You did.
I won a 10-speed in a readathon sponsored by the Multiple Sclerosis Society in eighth grade. And I was so excited because the bike that I had was a single-speed bike. And with my weak legs, I couldn't go that fast. But it seemed like all the kids in the neighborhood, or at least kids in my class, were getting these 10-speed bikes. And I thought, if only I had a 10-speed bike, I might be able to keep up better. I could switch the gears. I could make the pedaling easier when we're going up a hill and it got too tough. I just know I could go faster. And so in eighth grade, during the readathon, I read the books and raised the money, and somehow was one of several kids chosen in the city of Milwaukee to win a bike. And my parents and I went to Toys R Us one night, looked at lots of different bikes, and I was choosing between a black and red Kent and this brown Santa Fe Huffy, and I thought the Santa Fe Huffy looked more cool, so that's the one I picked.
Well, then, though, later you had a bad accident on this bike. And in fact, I think in the book you say, thinking back on the accident, talking about what happened, you say you didn't know it at the time, but it turned out to be one of the defining moments of your life.
My accident was a defining moment in my life. About 6 months after I got my bike licensed and was legally able to ride it around on the streets of Milwaukee, I was, it was about 2.5 months into my freshman year of high school. I was riding my bike and I came around a corner too sharp and the pedal dug into the cement. I slammed down on my hip and my hip dislocated. And I remember laying there and the bike was on top of me and the rear wheel was spinning. And my hip was just burning. And then all of a sudden, it stopped. And it seemed like I was there for 10 minutes, but it must have only been a couple of minutes. I was just hoping nobody I knew would come by because I was embarrassed that I fell over so easily. My hip must have slid back in the socket. I picked the bike up off of me, got back on, rode the last block home, parked my bike in the backyard, walked into the house. Didn't think of anything that had happened because I'd fallen down a lot, whether it was while I was walking or riding my bike. I was accustomed to falling down. That night, I was watching TV in our basement, and I got a telephone call from a friend of mine asking about a math problem or something. I can't remember. And as I walked to the stairs, I collapsed. My hip had dislocated for good. So I scooted up the stairs on my bottom, and I took that phone call. But when I couldn't stand up to hang up the phone, I knew that there was trouble, and so I called my dad, and he had worked for a short time with an ambulance company, and he was always reading my mom's medical books and journals and stuff because he was fascinated with medicine, and he was the one who saw what my hip looked like and knew something was wrong. Mm-hmm.
So then the upshot of all this was that you had to have surgery. You spent, almost a year in a full body cast?
Mm-hmm. I had 5 major hip operations over the next year and spent that time in a body cast that went from just below my chest all the way down. My hip socket was being reconstructed. The angle of my hip was being changed and reconstructed. And not only did they do surgeries on the left, but then they went ahead and did one on the right to make it was preventative to make sure that my right hip wouldn't dislocate as my left hip had. So I had a tutor who was coming to my school. We had to sell our piano to fit the hospital bed in our living room. And when I wasn't in the hospital, I was at home healing from surgery and getting ready for the next surgery. It was a very long year.
Hmm. So, then the result was once that you were out of the cast, then you found out the doctors determined that your legs wouldn't support your weight, and so that there was no question that you, even with braces, could walk.
Well, no, I was still able to walk, but after I got my last body cast off, I went home for about 2 weeks to try to get flexible in my hips and knees again. And then at the end of that 2 weeks, I went back for x-rays. When the doctor walked into my room after viewing the x-rays, his head was hanging, and he said, "We're sorry, none of the surgeries we did worked. Your hip is still dislocating. You're going to have to start walking on crutches, and you're probably going to have to start using a wheelchair for longer distances." And I was absolutely devastated. The hope that I had hung on to all year was that maybe I would walk better than before my accident. None of the doctors or nurses had told me that, but that was in my mind, and that was what I hoped. Prior to my accident, when I walked, my feet turned out to the side, and I swayed back and forth, and it just looked really awkward, and I was hoping that maybe with the surgery, now maybe my feet at least would face forward, and I could walk more similar to everybody else. And all of a sudden, in a couple minutes' time, that hope was dashed, and my heart just stopped. Hmm. It was very difficult to hear that my condition was worse rather than better after going through all of those many painful surgeries.
Yeah. And then I guess it was the thing that really opened up to you a lot of possibilities and got you turned around was the first time someone got you involved in wheelchair sports. I guess it was wheelchair basketball.
It was wheelchair soccer.
Wheelchair soccer.
Wheelchair soccer, yes.
I'm sorry, yes. I didn't know that there was such a thing as wheelchair
well,
soccer.
Well, I didn't know at that time either. I really struggled with needing to use the wheelchair. I went back to the high school where I started high school, and it was second semester, sophomore year. I wasn't comfortable with the chair, and I didn't know how to make other people comfortable with the wheelchair. And so I decided for my junior and senior year I was going to go to a different high school where the kids didn't know me. As walking, at least a lot of the kids didn't. There were some from my grade school who were in this high school, but you know, I could sort of start new. And at this new high school, my junior year, there was another guy there who also had spina bifida, also used a wheelchair. And he came up to me at the beginning of the school year and said, "Hey, how would you like to try wheelchair soccer?" And I looked at him really weird. "Wheelchair soccer? How do you play wheelchair soccer? You need your legs to play soccer." He said, "Oh, it's this really cool adapted game." And I heard that word adapted, and all these sirens went off in my head. I was like, no way. I am not one of those wheelchair people. They're weird. I don't want people to think the only friends I have are people in wheelchairs. The only boyfriends I can get are people in wheelchairs. I am not going to hang out with them. And so I resisted this guy's invitation all year until May of my junior year. And finally, to get him off my back, I decided I was going to go to the soccer practice. But it wasn't anything like I thought it was going to be. Chairs were crashing and banging and bodies
were flying.
People were
going flying out of their
chairs. Oh, it was so much fun.
And you thought, hey, pretty cool.
I thought, this is sport. This is sport. And the thing I really liked was that the supervisors of the program and the coaches of the program did not freak out when somebody fell out of their chair. There were some people there who had weaker upper bodies and needed help to get back in their chairs, and so people would run out and help them. But there were also others of us who had very well-developed upper bodies. I don't know how many of you have ever walked on crutches, but it's natural strength building. And so although I was still walking on crutches, I was using a chair too, and I had lots of strength. So when I'd get knocked over, all of a sudden I would see this electric wheelchair come barreling toward me, and I'd have the ball be like, you know, trying to get rid of it. And then, of course, once I got rid of it, then the chairs wouldn't be coming at me full bore. But then I'd get my chair up and get in it and continue playing, and a whole new world opened up to me.
Hmm. Just to go back to something that happened before this, you were a poster child.
Yes, I was.
For Easter Seals, right?
I was a poster child in the city of Milwaukee in 1976. I was 9 years old, and I had mixed emotions about that. The fun side of it was that it was the first time I was ever on TV, and it was the first time that my picture was ever in the paper, and there was an article, and of course I made sure my siblings saw that. But I also was very shy, and I think a lot of that had to do with my lack of self-esteem, just getting stared at and teased so much. I didn't like people, strangers, coming up to me and expecting a hug. I was not that kind of child. I was the child who would hide behind my parents. And I didn't like people patronizing me and looking at the way I walked. I didn't like being on that sort of a stage. So part of it was very difficult for me, but the other part, the attention from the media, that was really fun.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because in some of the things that I have read, people have written about the efforts to work for disabled rights and for disabled people talking about their experiences. They seem to have this real sort of mixed feeling about two images that are very prominent in the media. The poster child is one, and the super crip is the other. And you've been both.
This is the
on the one hand, you know, the child that's supposed to really elicit our sympathy, and that's used to raise money, mm-hmm, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is, you know, the guy with no legs who climbs Mount Everest.
Mm-hmm,
And I guess the trouble with those is that, in a way, sort of nobody really, whether you're able-bodied or disabled, it's sort of hard to relate to either of those things. And then that sets up, maybe it sets up a certain kinds of expectations that nobody really wants to live with or to try to live up to.
Well, one of the things I love about the platform I have now is the ability to do education about disability. Disability, depending on what it is, does have its limitations. But by and large, it is an attitude. There are people who are able to ambulate on two good legs, but they have a disabled frame of mind, and there is nobody that can change them. They consider themselves disabled, and they like to be waited on, and they feel that the world owes them everything. Conversely, there is a non-disabled frame of mind, and no matter what one's disability may or may not be, these people are people who want to get out and do things and not be limited. I've come to learn that our biggest limitations are the ones that we place on ourselves or the ones that we allow others to place on us. And once you understand that, you're mid-air jumping over the hurdle in front of you. My disability is a characteristic like hair color, eye color, skin color. It's not a defining principle. I do not have a master's degree because I have spina bifida. I have not gone jogging with President Clinton because I have spina bifida. I do not have world records because I have spina bifida. All these things have taken place because I have ability and I have achieved and I have worked very hard like anybody has to in order to meet goals that they set for themselves.
Yeah. Well, it seems very, very clear that the message that you want to get across to people is that you feel, as far as your success is concerned, it was a result of effort and hard work, and that's what you want to tell people that, don't kid yourself. If you're going to be successful, you're going to have to work at it, and you're going to have to work hard.
That's absolutely right. One of my biggest frustrations is that a lot of times people think that those who are successful were born that way. They were born into the right kind of family, into the right kind of situation, and they just sort of fell into success. And some people are born with it and some people aren't. Well, I'm here to tell you that is not how it goes. I had everything to lose when I was born, and doctors were saying as much. But I think that when I sign autographs, I sign dream big and work hard. And it's applicable to everybody, whether you're a child or an adult. People are afraid of dreaming big these days. They're afraid of seeing their names in marquee lights. And I'm not saying that you have to be a Garth Brooks or a Jackie Joyner-Kersee with names that big and popular familiarity that big. You could be the best teacher in a school and know that you're affecting lives. Affecting lives really is one of the greatest gifts we have, helping people feel good about themselves or just helping people have dignity. That's one of the greatest things. And so to dream big and work hard, to make the sacrifices of working hard is necessary in order to meet those goals that you have before you. And again, whether or not you have a disability or not, you can have a disabled frame of mind or a non-disabled frame of mind. Look at Stephen Hawking. He is very, very limited and I don't know if I would still be out doing research and doing the things that he is because he's so limited. I feel very blessed to be in my physical situation, and yet look at this incredibly intelligent man and what he offers our world as far as research and information goes.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here, and I probably should introduce again our guest. We're talking with Jean Driscoll. She was, I'll just list a few honors here. Mm-hmm. She was voted number 25 among top female athletes of the 20th century by Sports Illustrated for Women. She's graduated University of Illinois. She's won a number of medals in Paralympics. She is the 8-time winner of the Boston Marathon, the only person ever to win it 8 times. A lot has been written about her. She also is involved now in a nonprofit organization called Determined to Win, which is designed to help develop younger disabled athletes. And she has now published an autobiography. It's titled Determined to Win. So if you'd like to read more about her, you can do that. Look for it in the bookstore. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Having, you know, given the fact that you have achieved a lot, is there anything yet, though, that you would like to be able to do that you can't? And I'm not even talking about, you know, any great, it's not like huge regrets or anything like that, but, you know, is there something that you would say, well, you know, I really wish that I could do this thing, but, well, I can't?
Well, the only thing that comes to mind right now is winning an Olympic gold medal. I have a silver medal, but 3 weeks ago I announced my retirement from racing. The fire has dwindled over the last couple of years, and this last year it just felt too routine. It hasn't been as much fun, and it's been taking far too much energy to get motivated to do the kind of training that it takes to compete at the level I want to compete. So I announced my retirement, and although I believe it was the right decision, it still was very emotional, and you know, I never will get that Olympic gold medal. But I have 2 silvers, and also giving up the status as a celebrated athlete, it has been such a joy and so much fun to have people sharing the excitement in this community. Especially when I got back from the Boston Marathon this year, I had at least 3 people say that all of Champaign-Urbana was jumping up and down when I finally got number 8. I mean, that just filled up my heart, and it made me so appreciative of the people in this community and how they have shared in the excitement. So I'm not exactly sure what chapter in my life I'm entering. I know that I'm going to be doing a lot more speaking, and I hope to affect a lot more lives. Until this point, my speaking schedule has been very limited. From January to September, I didn't really accept any speaking engagements, because when you miss workouts, you don't win races. So I've had all of these months of blackout dates, and pleasantly, my speaking calendar is filling up quickly. But I also want to, through the nonprofit organization Determined to Win, help people to dream big and work hard. I want to help in their success. And it's not actually just for kids with disabilities or people with disabilities. It's for anybody who needs encouragement or a little bit of a jump start toward their goals. When I was first getting into racing, I needed a racing chair in order to be competitive. And there was a businessman in Milwaukee named Jim Dersey who bought my first racing chair for $2,000 and bought my first couple of years worth of airplane tickets and hotel bills. He paid for all of that. He jump-started my career. Without having someone like that to step forward, I would not have, A, been competitive in my everyday chair. B, I would not have been able to get the national and international experience to climb the ladder toward being one of the best in the world. So with the nonprofit organization Determined to Win, you know, I want to help encourage people to dream big and work hard, but I also hope at some point that we have a financial basis whereby we can help jumpstart some people toward their careers or their dreams.
When you were in peak training, how much time did you actually spend doing that?
Well, up until just a couple months ago, I'd been training 6 days a week, 2 to 4 hours a day. Most days were 2-a-day workouts. Once in a while, there were 3-a-day workouts. But it literally was my lifestyle. If I wasn't working out, I was resting and recovering for the next workout. I was always thinking about the next workout or the race that I was getting ready for. It was all inclusive as far as my time and how I plan my day.
Mm. Well, what sort of things were part of your workout regimen? What did you do?
Well, when I was getting ready for the Boston Marathon, for example, I was lifting 3 to 4 times a week, weightlifting 3 to 4 times a week, and I had a max bench press of 210 pounds. I'm very proud of that and love telling high school guys that. and then as far as mileage goes, I was putting in right around 130 miles a week. There was one year that I was doing 150 miles a week. But just going out and pounding the roads, and when the snow and ice were on the ground, then I would stay inside and pound on rollers. Rollers are similar to wind trainers that cyclists would use. And you put your rear wheels on a cylindrical drum and you spin in place. The front end of my chair would be clamped down. And you could do long distance pushing. You could do intervals. I also did cross training on a hand cycle, which is a bike that you can crank with your hands and it's geared. On a speed bag, I was doing cross training to wake up some of the fast twitch muscle fibers that are not really a part of my makeup. People have fast twitch and slow twitch muscle fibers, and fast twitch muscle fiber people are usually your sprinters, and the slower twitch are usually your longer distance people. And I lost too many sprints by very close margins because I just didn't have enough of that quick fire power. But with a speed bag, I would try to wake up some of that and train some of my muscles to fire faster.
Yeah, and that's the bag that boxers use.
Yes,
that where you see people, it's the one that looks sort of like a teardrop,
right?
And that you people punch very, very fast in this very sort of rhythmic kind of way,
right?
Opposed to the heavy bag, which is the big cylinder that sort of hangs and is very, very heavy.
Yes, very heavy.
So, well, what you're doing is you're using the muscles of your upper body to propel yourself.
Using every functional muscle in my upper body to push as efficiently and as powerfully as possible to make my racing chair go faster than any other woman in the world.
And I guess the thing I'm interested in is how certainly strength is very important, but there must be it's not just as simple as that. There must be a lot more.
Oh, there's definitely technique involved. My racing chair is custom made. My racing chair, I have a different way of sitting in my racing chair than my teammate Adam Blakeney. And it's because the way I sit makes me push more efficiently and more powerfully, and the way Adam sits makes him push more powerfully. But there is a technique. There are specific gloves that we use. There is a specific part on the push rim where you want to be pushing, and there are different phases that go into learning the stroke. You want your shoulders positioned a certain way. You want your knees positioned a certain way. Again, it's very individual, but it's also very technical. And Marty Morse is, without a doubt in my mind, the best coach in the world when it comes to wheelchair racing. He developed the pushing stroke that we're all using now. It's called the Illinois backhand. And he was watching how quadriplegic racers were running times that were within 10% of paraplegic athletes, and yet they had less functional muscle. And he was looking at the stroke they were using, which was sort of on the tops of their fingers. And so he'd get into a racing chair and experiment with it and develop this Illinois backhand that is now used around the world. And he also was instrumental in developing the glove, along with Deb Harness, who lives here in Champaign. This glove is used worldwide. The pushing technique is used worldwide. And I have been a beneficiary of this research, and it's made me go very fast.
Mm. You talked about how when you were starting out, somebody helped you out because the chair, the racing chair, was expensive.
Yes.
What now? What's the cost of a state of the art chair that you would say use in doing marathon?
Well, state-of-the-art, top-level athletes will have a chair. The racing chair alone is probably $1,500, $1,600. And then that's just if you keep the regular spoked wheels on there. But we're all using carbon fiber wheels, just like the racing cyclists use. And so those wheels start to get expensive, and they're anywhere from $500 a pair to $1,500 a pair, depending on what type you get and where you get them from. There's a French-made wheel that I paid $1,500 to have, the pair actually, to have. The front wheel is also carbon fiber. And the wheel technology really is where a lot of emphasis has been placed in the last couple of years in our sport. And people are always looking at different makeups of frames and things like that. But so if your wheels are $1,500 and your frame is $1,600 or $800, it's a pretty good investment, over $3,000.
Yeah. There is, I guess that there was and continues to be some discussion among people who are involved in the Paralympics, who say, you know, why do we have two Olympics? That there really should be one. That all athletes should be in the same competition. Do you think that's actually possible?
Well, to begin with, for those of you who aren't familiar with what the Paralympic Games are, it's Olympic competition for athletes with physical disabilities. Most people don't know this, but there are actually two Olympic Games in a given Olympic year. The Olympic Games go first, and 2 weeks later, the Paralympic Games are held. The Paralympic Games have competition for athletes who are visually impaired, for wheelchair athletes, athletes with cerebral palsy, athletes who are dwarfs, and those who are amputees. There are lots of different classifications for each disability. And what I mean by that is within wheelchair racing, for example, you can be classified as a T1, a T2, a T3, or a T4. If you are a T1, if you are a class T1, it means that you are a high-level quadriplegic. You have a spinal cord injury high in your neck. A lot of times when people hear about quadriplegia, they think of Christopher Reeves, and that's the only type of quadriplegia. But that's not the case. A lot of people who have quadriplegia are independent or are at least are able to be mobile. Depending on how close to the brain they are, they may or may not have more or less function. As I explained earlier, when you have a spinal cord injury or an opening in the spine with spina bifida, the closer to the brain you are, the more damage there is, the less function you have. So if you're a T1 quad, you are a high-level quad. It means you are a quadriplegic. You have affect there. You have weakness in both arms and both legs, and because you're higher on your spinal cord than what a low-level quadriplegic would be, you are racing in a different category. People who are T1 athletes, by and large, don't have triceps, functional triceps. May not have functional biceps, may have some loss of forearm musculature. They don't have any functional stomach muscles or lower back muscles. Their injury is very high. T2 is a lower level quadriplegic. They don't have as much function as a paraplegic, but they have more than a high level quadriplegic. High level and low level is just where in the cervical region people have injured their spinal cord. It's either high in the cervical area or low. Then T3 is a high-level paraplegic. These people have functional muscles all in their arms, but do not have functional stomach muscles or lower back muscles, and so their balance isn't as good, and they don't have the strength like on starts and such. So they are in a category by themselves, and then a T4 is a lower-level paraplegic. So you have T1, T2, T3, T4. Each of those categories does a 100-meter race. They do quarterfinals, semis, finals. They do a 200. They do a 400. They do an 800. Men do it and women do it. There are many, many, many more races for Paralympic athletes than there are at the Olympic Games, because you have many, many, many different classifications other than just male or female. Because of that, the Olympics would never end if the Olympic Games and the Paralympic Games were held at the same time. There would not be enough lodging. There would not be enough sponsor support that could take care of both events together. So logistically, there is a reason that they are separate. My big beef is that because the Paralympics are not held at the same time as the Olympics, a lot of times people deem Paralympic athletes as less talented, as less quote-unquote important. You know, my value does not come from the next person's judgment, but it's frustrating when you are not recognized as an elite-level athlete, and yet you're training at the same level as elite-level athletes. I put the same amount of time in as any Olympic athlete does, and I appreciate. That's why I love the Boston Marathon so much. At Boston, we are athletes. We are invited to all the same press conferences. We are seen and understood as elite-level athletes, and I love that.
Well, some people, I guess, have... Now, admittedly, it gets as you have explained, it sort of gets complicated. But
yes.
Some people have talked about, say, well, okay, you could take an event, say, take the marathon.
Sure.
And we could make wheelchair marathon a regular Olympic sport if we said, okay, well, able-bodied athletes, if you wanted to, go ahead, enter the, get yourself a race and share in another race. Go for it. But that you would have to do that. You would have to say, well, the issue is that you're racing in a chair. It should be open to anybody, whether they can walk or not. What would you think about something like that?
Well, I would love to have our marathon run with the Olympic marathoners. That I think, looking at other road races that are done around the year and around the world, that is something that's very feasible. But then you have other athletes in other events who also want to do the same, and then it becomes an issue of, well, what's fair and what's not fair. At the Olympic Games, there are two wheelchair exhibition events. There's an 800-meter event for women and a 1,500-meter event for men. When I was referring before to having won an Olympic silver medal, it was in these Olympic wheelchair exhibition events. But there are a lot of other disability groups that are saying, why do the wheelchair athletes always get to do that event? Wheelchair basketball would like to do it. Visually impaired tandem cycling would like to do an event. Everybody is vying to get onto the Olympic stage. So it gets very political and very it's a difficult thing to resolve.
But having it be a demonstration event at the Olympics is a good thing for...
Oh, it's very good.
For
it's,
awareness.
It's wonderful exposure, and it is education in and of itself. And sport is such a wonderful vehicle for education of disability. People in those races, in the 800-meter or the men's 1,500-meter, people can see tactics developing. I mean, the sport borrows from both running and from cycling. They can also see that the times are faster than able-bodied runners, and they can appreciate the athletes, because usually athletes in those Olympic exhibition events are very thickly muscled, very lean, and look just as much like world-class athletes as everybody else. Now, one thing I want to add, people might be confused about Paralympics and Special Olympics. Oftentimes people get me confused with people who participate in the Special Olympics. Special Olympics is something for people with mental disabilities, and the emphasis is on participation. Fitness is something that's important for everybody. And whether you're 5 or 95, whether you're 100 pounds or 300 pounds, whether or not you have a disability, fitness is important for everybody. And Special Olympics is so important because it gives people with mental disabilities an opportunity to compete and also to engage in fitness activities. The Paralympic Games are different because you have to qualify to get there, just like at the Olympic Games. And you have to come within a certain percentage of world record times in order to get there. It is the elite of the elite who compete. And incidentally, the Paralympic Games are held in the same Olympic city, same Olympic venues. We stayed in the same athletes' village, ate the same food. So they are very parallel. And Paralympics, it means parallel to the Olympics.
Mm. We've got a couple of minutes left. We do have a caller here, so we'll bring him into the conversation. Caller here is in Lovington, and it's line number 4. Hello.
Morning.
Yeah.
It's been pretty interesting hearing your story.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. How does the times compare compared in similar races to a wheelchair athlete, a running athlete?
Well, I can best tell you the comparison with a 10K event or a marathon. In the marathon, for instance, my world record time for the women's wheelchair division is 1 hour, 34 minutes, and 22 seconds. The world record for an able-bodied female runner is 2 hours and 20 minutes. For an able-bodied male runner, it's 2 hours and 5 minutes. Wheels are more efficient than legs.
I've seen little, you know, bits of races on TV, and it's like they're flying. Kind of wondering whether you wouldn't be fast in a wheelchair. It sounds like you're quite a bit fast.
Yeah. Well, distance is different than sprints. If you're looking at sprinting, able-bodied athletes are faster in the 100-meter, 200-meter, 400-meter events. We're fairly equal when it comes to 800 meters, both for men and women. But once you get above 800 meters, wheelers are typically have faster times. I can't remember what the world record for the 1500 meter is for able-bodied men. I want to say it's like 3 minutes, 20 seconds. And the world record for a male wheelchair athlete in the 1500 is 2 minutes and 58 seconds or something like that. So the longer you go, the faster the wheelers get.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Sure. Right,
thank you. Well, I guess we're just about to point that we're going to have to stop. I think we've got somebody calling in, but I'm sorry. I don't really think we have time to take the call. For anybody, though, who's interested in reading more about Jean Driscoll and her experiences in life, you can look for the book that we mentioned, her autobiography, Determined to Win, is the title of the book. And Harold Shaw is the publisher. I'm sure it should be available in bookstores locally.
It is available in local bookstores. I know that some people have had trouble because the book has actually been selling out, which is such a compliment to me. But I know that there are a couple stores that do have it now in stock.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
We appreciate it.